Thank you for joining us for this episode of Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. On February 8, 1885, 943 immigrant laborers from Japan disembarked the Pacific Mail Steamship Company's City of Tokyo onto the dock at Honolulu Harbor in the Kingdom of Hawaii. They came from small agricultural prefectures in Japan, like Hiroshima and Okinawa. Because the American Civil War decimated the southern plantations, sugar plantations in Hawaii proliferated, bringing in millions of dollars of profit and driving the need for labor. With the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, plantation owners looked to other Asian groups to find workers. Between 1885 and 1907, thousands of Japanese came to Hawaii in numbers so great that by 1897, they made up the largest single ethnic group in the islands, and by 1900, they numbered around 40% of the population in Hawaii. My name is Amy Bachari, and I am the Education Director. Today, I'm here with Dr. Kelly Nakamura to discuss Japanese immigration by steamship and picture brides, a practice of arranged marriages where partners were selected by photo and personal recommendations from friends and family. To learn more about our organization, visit sshsa.org. Dr. Nakamura is an associate professor at the University of Hawaii System, a scholar and a journal editor at the Hawaiian Journal of History. She's a published author, researcher, and educator committed to embracing curricular innovation and best practices, particularly in online learning for underrepresented populations throughout the Asia Pacific region. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me to be here, Amy.
Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about your own research and some of your publications.
Thank you. So greetings, everyone. My name is Kelly Nakamura. I am a professor of history and ethnic studies here at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, as well as Kapi'olani Community College, also on Oahu, which is, of course, one of the major islands of the Hawaiian island chain. I do focus on Japanese-American history, particularly during the World War II period. And I also do a number of different articles on incarceration, labor, sports, cultural activities. It just pretty much runs the gamut. So any kind of ethnic history or ethnic stories, that is kind of my specialty, or at least my focus of study.
And can you tell us a little bit about Asian immigration to the U.S. in general, and maybe a bit about the Chinese Exclusion Act?
That's a great question. So when we're talking about Asian immigration, it primarily began in the mid to late 19th century in America. So really kind of the seminal moment in kind of encouraging Asians to come over was the California Gold Rush. So think about San Francisco 49ers and think about the California Gold Rush occurring during that particular time. So right before the Civil War, we're going to have a large number of Asian immigrants, primarily beginning with the Chinese, arriving for economic opportunities in America. So the Chinese would arrive. Not only would they, of course, participate in the California Gold Rush, but they also extended to other industries and businesses, such as the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. Many of them also became just general laborers. They opened small businesses, laundry services, to meet the needs of essentially a migrating American population that was very fluid in the 19th century. So first the Chinese would arrive, and later we're going to see increasingly stringent or restrictive immigration policies directed specifically at the Chinese because of their large numbers that would spur on kind of racist immigration, such as the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. And we're going to see, of course, it encouraging then not just simply the stopping or ending of Chinese immigration, but because of the labor needs, further encouragement of, ironically, other Asian groups to actually arrive. Later, of course, the Japanese, and then, of course, later, other immigrant groups such as the Koreans, Filipinos, and others.
Can you talk a bit about Japanese immigration, and did the Chinese Exclusion Act affect Japanese?
That's a great question. So when really talking about Japanese immigration, we really have to look at two places, which is primarily going to be Hawaii and California. Hawaii being primarily the stopping off point for further immigration to the West Coast of the United States. So beginning in 1868, we're actually going to see the arrival of the first Japanese immigrants to Hawaii or the islands. And that was actually kind of a test case to see about the feasibility, the appropriateness of these laborers. Unfortunately, many of them were unused to the hard plantation work, the really kind of different climate of Hawaii, and eventually many of them, in fact, did actually return. But that would not actually stop the real immigration that would begin a few decades later during, you know, when we're really talking about the large-scale arrival of Japanese, and we're really going to see the plantations, particularly in Hawaii, driving the need for labor. You know, just kind of a broader historical context of why the plantations were so profitable. Remember, the plantations really would flourish in the 19th and 20th century because, in part, we had the American Civil War. So 1861 to 1865, basically the southern sugar-producing region of the United States was decimated because of the American Civil War. So that's what made essentially plantation and even sugar importation across the Pacific so lucrative. You know, it was viable to, in fact, import or transport sugar from these far across places, even transcontinentally to different parts of the Americas. And later, of course, we're also going to see these immigrants later arriving in places like California. Now, the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act really did impact Japanese in very specific ways in talking about not just, of course, unfortunately, the Japanese, but other Asian immigration groups. So looking at the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, it kind of set, unfortunately, a precedent for restrictive immigration policies directed specifically at Asian groups for the sole basis of race. It also, unfortunately, set a federal precedent for discriminatory legislation directed specifically at Asians, and in particular Japanese and Chinese Americans at this particular time. So when we see essentially the start of this kind of discriminatory legislation, it would later give birth to alien land laws, particularly in California, for example, that would prohibit Asian immigrants from actually purchasing and owning land. So it really kind of disenfranchised them. And in fact, it would only be until about 1952, in which Asian immigrants, we're talking about first generation, were actually given or allowed to pursue citizenship here in the United States. So decades later.
Wow. I mean, Asians were the only people excluded based on race for citizenship, right? That didn't apply to any other groups at the time.
Right. I mean, we do see, you know, you folks are deeply involved in kind of the immigration history of the East Coast, and we're going to be talking about European groups primarily arriving on the shores of essentially great cities like Philadelphia, Boston, New York, among others. We're really going to see kind of a different group of immigration. Primarily, of course, on the West Coast, we really see kind of federal officials concentrated on limiting these so-called undesirable populations here in America. That necessarily wasn't the case with the arrival of other European groups.
Can you talk a little bit about what was driving Japanese to Hawaii? I know you mentioned the plantations, but was there anything specific that was sort of pushing them out of Japan at the time and pulling them toward Hawaii or further emigrating to the West Coast?
That is a great question. So there's kind of this push-pull. So in America, we have this pull for, or at least demand for new laborers to meet essentially the California Gold Rush, the development of the West Coast of the United States. We also see, of course, the flourishing of the plantations here in Hawaii that really would encourage or pull the interests of essentially migrant workers. In Japan, we also have a push. So we also have this beginning of the modernization of Japan with the Meiji Restoration. So think about the 1860s, and we're really going to see Japan trying to modernize. And one of the critical factors in which they would attempt this modernization is to create a modern tax system based upon the reliable collection of taxes, particularly on land. So what we're going to see for the very first time is that regular standardized taxes would be implemented on already kind of impoverished peasant population who literally couldn't pay their taxes. So the joke in my family is, but it's not actually a joke, but kind of more the reality is that, you know, we immigrated. So I'm fourth generation. We immigrated generations ago because, according to my dad, we were the Japanese that couldn't make it in Japan. You know, we had a difficult time. We were impoverished. We had very limited opportunities. And we also see not just the farming class forced to immigrate, but due to the Meiji reforms, we see the abolishment of the samurai class. So we have basically unemployed samurai, or, you know, this formerly high class within Japanese society, also seeking new opportunities. So when you look at the immigration, particularly in Hawaii, of where Japanese actually came from in Japan, we're looking at the southern kind of agricultural regions of Hiroshima, Fukuoka, Wakayama, among others. So, you know, you talk to Japanese here, and they can pretty much trace their origins to a particular prefecture, usually an agricultural prefecture in Japan.
And so when they got to Hawaii, and you said they worked on plantations, maybe you can talk just a bit about what type of work they did and what the labor conditions would have been like at the time.
You know, a lot of people kind of romanticize the life on the plantations, this beautiful, idyllic kind of environment in which essentially, you know, you had the great house and you had workers happily toiling away in the fields. But in reality, that was quite the opposite. So in talking about the plantations, it was backbreaking, demoralizing, incredibly difficult work that took place from sun up. So here in Hawaii, right now, we can't tell, but it's 6 in the morning here, and already the sun is up, and we're ready to go. So we're really going to think about starting from 6 a.m. and during the summer months, you know, we really don't see true darkness until about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. So we're talking about nearly a 12 to 14 hour labor day in the hot fields of Hawaii. We're talking about no shade, no basically relief from the relentless bearing of the sun, the wind, the rain. Agricultural work is incredibly difficult. We're talking about the process of not just tilling the fields, making it ready for cultivation, but also planting, weeding, watering, harvesting, and then the cycle begins all over again. So cane production is a very labor-intensive, long, drawn-out process. And if you've ever visited cane fields, you know, they start off as these little shoots in the ground, these little plants, and these cane stalks can grow up to 6 feet plus that literally cover you, and then you have to literally chop it or burn it down. And the process starts all over again. My grandparents, my grandfather was born and raised on a plantation in Kapa'a, Kauai. And the reason why education was so emphasized in my family was the fact that my grandfather said, you are never going to do this kind of work. It is terrible, harsh, demoralizing work. So, you know, in talking about why education is so emphasized in certain Asian American communities, if you've had relatives, great-grandparents or grandparents who actually worked on the plantations, I said, I'm only two generations removed from the plantation. It inspires you to go to college and do something else with your life because you recognize and understand how difficult it actually is.
So did they intend to stay and live in Hawaii, or did they intend to work and go back? Did people bring their families?
Those are all wonderful questions. So, you know, that brings me back to a particular point. So the majority of laborers or immigrants who first arrived were primarily men. Men thought that this would be kind of a temporary work assignment. This was something that they had did in Japan, where they went to different provinces or different prefectures, and they would work, make money, bring it back, essentially to live in their hometowns. So this practice of going abroad or to different areas for labor just for a short period of time was something recognized. So many, in fact, arrived thinking, I'm going to make a lot of money. Hawaii, America is a place of opportunity. I'm going to return back within a few years, a rich person, and be able to really establish myself back in my home country. Unfortunately, many of these men realized how difficult it was actually to accrue savings. They weren't paid a lot. They were at the mercy of the plantation bosses who would regularly dock or fine them for coming late to work or malingering or any of these literally hundreds of different regulations that applied on the plantations. So many soon realized after a few years that they were financially unable to return. There was also kind of a pride thing that, you know, you're telling everyone, I'll be back in a few years, you know, I'll be rich and, you know, have made my fortune. And when you're not able to do so, I mean, that really is also a different kind of element that prevents you from actually returning, because, you know, you're going to lose face as far as not being as successful as you had promised everyone that you actually were. So then you see essentially these young men actually writing home to their families saying, I'm going to be staying in Hawaii. I'm going to establish a family. I'm going to establish a life. So please, if you have anyone, arrange a marriage for me. And by the way, that is something that was not unheard of within the Japanese community or within many Asian communities, where families would arrange marriages. We had nakodos or matchmakers or go-betweens between different families who would interview both parties or both families to essentially determine the suitability of a particular match. So your families would actually arrange a marriage. So it's kind of like early dating services that actually sometimes in some communities still go on. I'm sure some parents would love to choose their partners for their children. But we really do see essentially this unique practice in Japan where parents would essentially arrange a marriage. And the practice of marriage is not what we are very familiar with in the West. So upon deciding the suitability of a marriage, the wife's name or the woman's name would then be removed from her family registry, the koseki, and then written in her new spouse's family's family registry. So if you look at kind of the family tree, you're going to see, in a sense, metaphorically, one branch being severed, the daughter leaving and joining another particular family. So you didn't actually have to get married in person. Your parents could arrange it. You simply essentially agree to this match and your name as a woman would be removed from your family registry because you didn't have an identity anymore to your family, but rather to your new spouse. And that is how people got married. So sometimes it was, you know, an overseas marriage, literally, which partners were married but didn't actually see each other or meet each other until they were, in fact, united or reunited. So we did see sometimes married couples come over, but we also see this picture bride practice of men sending requests to their families back in Japan and these women coming over, seeking opportunities, seeking a fresh start. You see a picture.
Fascinating.
And, you know, you develop this kind of narrative of the appropriateness or the suitability of a person. So, you know, before we, you know, we criticize or make fun of people who go online for dating, I said, oh, no, people, we've been doing this for decades, for over 100 years, where, you know, this technology of photography that flourished or began in the late or mid 19th century really helped develop a new way of people meeting and developing relationships with one another. So we had, in fact, photography studios that would, in fact, also be created here in Hawaii. Sometimes these men, of course, would also send older pictures of themselves when they were younger, taken back in Japan, and say, this is what I look like now, and essentially send it back to their parents. And these women would not realize that these pictures were considerably older than what they actually were. And so when they actually met, it was often a surprise for both of them.
Mary Hirata shares her mother's account of being a picture bride and how other women fared from this 1998 interview from the Densho Digital Archive.
Well, my father's friend was going to Japan to get his wife, and he had asked this man if he would find him a wife. So this man found my mother, and so they made arrangements for her to come over. She was saying that the one thing she remembers mostly about it was a lot of the ladies had gotten pictures of their future spouses when they were very young. And so when the boat docked in Tacoma, they were really upset because here were these old men waiting for these young girls. My mother was much older, so it didn't bother her, and she knew what she was where she was going, but she said she felt very sorry for some of the girls because they were very young. And she said a lot of them just ran away.
So think about what we do right now when, you know, we have online portraits. You mean you try to have the best possible light, or you try to show yourself in a particularly flattering angle, or maybe a younger picture of yourself. But when you actually meet that person, the reality could be very different.
You know, the fact that there were girls that would show up to meet their husband for the first time, and they couldn't find them because they were so much older, they didn't look at all like their picture.
I mean, traditionally, the men were older because they did spend years, sometimes decades in Hawaii, trying to make their fortune, trying to raise enough money to be able to afford a bride actually arriving. So there was often an age disparity. And so, you know, imagine this young woman, this young bride, you know, seeking, of course, additional opportunities, you know, more suitable marriage partners and the gentleman in her particular hometown arriving. And, you know, you're absolutely right. There are stories from the immigration station or the immigration centers in which, you know, these women are carrying around pictures and either A, couldn't identify who their husbands were, or were shocked at the age, the difference in appearance, or completely a different person than what they had in fact anticipated. So, I mean, these women were catfished, but to give credit, they also sent more attractive pictures than themselves or of their friends or of their family members. So, you know, not to completely criticize the men, but, you know, often there was deception on both parts where, you know, you're trying to present yourself in a different light, whether it be an actual accurate photo of yourself or someone else. And some, you know, women, I mean, you did hear stories about, they just burst into tears upon seeing their husbands and seeing that as a person, you know, you're as old as my father, which could in fact be plausible and in fact true. You're not who I thought it was. And these guys would also elevate their job, you know, status on the plantation. You know, I'm an engineering operator. You're an elevator boy. You know, I'm an agricultural technician. You hoe weeds. You know, so this is where, you know, there was also deception on their attractiveness from an economic standpoint of them being able to provide. And of course, you know, these women, you know, some did run away. Some resigned themselves because, you know, here are these women in a foreign country with limited to no language skills, lacking citizenship, and would be in fact denied citizenship, and at the mercy of essentially this pressure from both families to ensure the success of these marriages. So, you know, we also hear a lot of stories of, yes, happy relationships, but we also hear stories about divorce because, you know, these relationships were unsuitable. They were untenable. They were unsuccessful. And that's not something that, you know, many people think about. This is what happened in the immigrant community back with my grandparents or my great-grandparents. You know, we have this myth that, oh, you know, your grandparents, they knew how to do it right. No one got divorced back in the day. But, you know, we have estimates of at least 30 to 40% of the marriages failing. Or at least essentially, and these are the ones that got formally divorced versus the ones, as you mentioned, who ran away, never showed up.
Toshi Nakamori shares the story of her mother's work with runaway picture brides at the Jane Couch Home in Los Angeles from this 2010 interview from the Densho Digital Archive.
Well, I think she just thought it was a good opportunity for her, you know, because she didn't want to marry at the time because they had picked out a husband for her that she didn't want to marry. So I think this was a good escape. The Jane Couch Home was a shelter for the Japanese picture brides that if their marriages didn't succeed or these picture brides came without knowing one thing about their husbands usually. And sometimes there were personality clashes, and sometimes these women were lied to, and sometimes these men were much older than they said they were. And so there was many obstacles for them. And so they, some of them came to the shelter to get away from their husbands, and they brought their children with them. And there were also orphan children in this home.
And so people, you know, I just had an email from a colleague asking about their particular family history. And they said, you know, it's really weird, especially when we're doing Ancestry.com. This is where people get into trouble. They realize they have different related relatives, but not a branch of the family that they recognize. So they realize that maybe this is grandma or grandpa's second, third marriage. And there's other family members that were in fact running around. So that, you know, these DNA tests really bring up these questions that families have revising their own kind of history.
That's really fascinating. And I think just drawing the parallels between modern dating is really interesting as a way to look at, you know, how people might send images of themselves that are maybe younger or more flattering. They start doing
pictures of their friends.
Yeah, right? Or their job title might be, you know, like catfishing is an age-old art, and it's not, it wasn't invented with online dating. And I think that's really interesting.
I mean, you know, these women somewhat had an opportunity to reject their marriage partner. So, you know, think 90 Day Fiancé or whatever that show is called, right? Where people say, like, how do people decide to get married? And then they meet each other, right? And you're thinking, that's just so surreal. I said, no, people were doing it back in the day. Photography was a brand new technology that really transformed. You know, we as humans are often very visual. And we impart meaning to saying, this is the right person. I know this is a nice individual who will work well with me, not knowing anything about their character, anything about this. Now, some picture brides, you know, to be fair, did find this gender imbalance empowering. So, you know, of course, you know, as we mentioned before, some women were at a disadvantage because they had language skills, they had citizenship issues. They were outnumbered by men in a primarily bachelor community. You also hear wonderful stories about, you know, women coming over and saying, my God, Hawaii is a paradise. Men cross mountains to see me. I, in my hometown, was undateable. And now hordes of men flock and propose to me every single day. So, you know, you do have the opposite where, you know, you have these women who would never be given a second glance back in their hometown, which is, again, why they in part immigrated. But because of the gender imbalance, there just wasn't enough women. So they had their pick of marriage partners or potential partners. In talking about the gender imbalance, it also worked to, depends how you look at it, a disadvantage or an advantage for women, that there was an opportunity whereby instead of doing backbreaking plantation work, some women actually voluntarily engaged in the practice of prostitution. Because it was so much more lucrative, so much physically easier to have sex with someone for a few minutes than literally spending the entire day trying to make a fraction of that particular payment that you would get. So, you know, some women capitalize on this gender imbalance. Some women, by the way, were also forced into prostitution by their husbands. So sometimes, you know, husbands brought over brides, not actually intending to marry them, but to sell them off to prostitution houses that in fact flourished on the plantations. So it's kind of a very precarious situation for these women. They had to really trust what they were doing.
You're just going to a new place and you don't really know. You just have the word of family or friends who say that this is a good match, and you really don't know what you're stepping into. And then I think a lot of times when people immigrate, they're expecting like this really lavish and, oh, it's going to be so great. And there's so much money and everything's really amazing there. And they get there and realize it's not really what they had hoped it would be, you know, that it's harder. There's not as much money. They're also, I'm sure, facing racism, you know, all over the place. And so it's just probably pretty isolating as well, especially without having a lot of English maybe coming over initially. You're sort of stuck in that community. And if you're not in with the right people, that could be really scary.
Well, you know how difficult it is to move, you know, to a brand new country, right? I mean, just figuring out, you know, where's the grocery store, you know, currency exchange rates, you know, just local laws, ordinances, who are my neighbors, you know, what is happening here? So when we're thinking about plantations, we're thinking about truly spread out commercial crop enterprises across the islands. So, you know, I encourage everyone to come to Hawaii. And people think, you know, islands are very small. That is true. And these plantations were spread out across the islands. So think about, you know, traveling through, you know, these isolated cane fields for literally miles, even on your car, and thinking about, my gosh, there's no streetlights. There's no markings on the road, really. I mean, my gosh, if I got lost, no one will find out where I actually was. You know, rely so much right now as modern travelers on Google Maps and cell phones, if we ever get lost, that kind of, you know, security. But imagine going to a brand new place and being, you know, driven for 4 miles, you know, in a cart to this plantation in the middle of nowhere, primarily men. You didn't have any kind of support system. And if, in fact, you did get married and have children, it's very difficult for these women because they didn't have that kin network that I think many women benefit from, a support network of, you know, other women to help guide them through, for example, even the birthing process. So, you know, these women sometimes have had to give birth by themselves or with the assistance of their husbands. So, you know, just think about like the logistics of, in fact, starting a family. There were no hospitals, so there were very limited medical facilities. You didn't have the support or advice of women to be able to go through the process of pregnancy, raise and bear a child, and ensure that, in fact, that child lived, right? I mean, we could just call up someone or, you know, with Google Answers, what's going on? But just, you know, child rearing is this incredibly challenging experience that parents go through. And
there's so many little things you don't consider. And yeah, even in modern day society, it's so challenging for immigrants to have to navigate bureaucracies and how do you get health services. And I mean, like, we actually have health services now, whereas, like you were saying, there's no hospitals and these women were just, you know, some of them on their own giving birth. That's just, that's horrifying to me.
With the assistance of their husbands, you know, who also didn't know what they were doing either. I mean, so, you know, we were just talking in my class about this very phenomenon of Asian immigration. And they said, why did these women or these families have so many children? So, for example, you know, you look at, you know, previous immigrant generations, you know, having 8, 9, 10 plus children was not uncommon. Number one, there was not recognized reliable birth control. And number two, many of these families were playing the numbers game where you anticipated that sometimes maybe pregnancies would not be successful or that you anticipated that childhood illness would take a few kids or even later that some of them wouldn't make it to adulthood. So that's where you do have large numbers of family members and you just simply hoped and prayed that your children would actually come into adulthood. It was to an advantage of these particular immigrants to have large numbers also because they would assist in the labor of plantations once they got old enough. So people always ask me then, they said, okay, so, you know, these women would have babies, so where's the childcare? And I said, the childcare is you literally strap on the baby to your body and there was no, you know, maternity leave, there was no break in your labor. You literally strap these babies onto your bodies or left them in the middle of the field while you did labor. So you just literally are strapping on children as you're also trying to breastfeed them, change them, do all of these things. And you yourself having gone through this process of birth and being forced back into the fields themselves. So we do have instances of children dying on the plantations. Some of them rolled into irrigation ditches and they would drown. Some of them got lost. Some of them, you know, heat exposures, you know, sun exposure. It was a very dangerous place.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about photography because it played such an important role, obviously, in the practice of picture brides and immigration. So photography in general was invented in the 1820s.
Yes.
So would it have been readily available or affordable to these types of families, especially the agricultural families? It seemed like it would be a big expense to
do that. It absolutely was. It absolutely was. So we did have photography studios, of course, back in Japan. And this is where these men would send older pictures of themselves because, you know, the technology was just not available on their particular plantations. We also have individuals here in Hawaii. There are these small photography studios or individuals known as shashinya. These are photographers who would literally go around. And what you would do is utilize them for very specific purposes. So it wasn't kind of this everyday, you know, people are taking selfies of each other, just kind of these candid shots that they're posting. But rather, these are kind of very formal pictures, often done in a studio to commemorate certain events. So number one, you would take an official portrait if you had to essentially send away to get a particular spouse, or once you got married and had established yourself with children. Another practice that they actually did was funeral photographs. So many of these immigrant workers would in fact not be able to return to their hometowns or to their families. But to demonstrate that, in fact, they had made it in America, made it in Hawaii, they would take these elaborate funeral photographs of, you know, maybe their ashes, but really kind of this panoramic view of the community coming out to honor the life of these individuals. And this is what the photograph would be to send back to your family, to be sending back to your parents, to essentially provide evidence that your life mattered, that you were able, your last kind of action to demonstrate that you had been a success was to create this photograph. And you see these beautiful panoramic images of, you know, the entire plantation community coming out, the Buddhist priest, you know, flowers, you know, your friends and maybe even your family if you did have to commemorate the life that you had. So photography, when you think about it, you know, developed during the 19th century, but really was utilized in very unique ways. You know, the Civil War was a very unique kind of phenomenon where we saw for the very first time for many Americans a documented effects of war. So you do see this very unique usage of photography. So all you influencers, what you're doing is nothing new. Because, you know, people use images to communicate certain messages, whether it be I'm a prospective spouse, or here's my family, or here is the encapsulation of my life, my final portrait.
Okay, so my next question would be about the women traveling by steamship. Yeah. Yes. Would they be traveling alone? And maybe you can talk about who would have paid their fare and what class they would have traveled in. If you know anything about the conditions, that would be great.
When we're talking about traveling, literally it would take weeks from Japan to Hawaii. And despite the fact that it is called the Pacific Ocean, we know that, in fact, it is very rough traveling for weeks on end. And you also read about accounts of women just being sick and miserable the entire process. So you're absolutely right in saying, or at least highlighting the fact that these women came from very humble backgrounds. So many of them were at the lowest steerage class in the ship. Many of them did not have the opportunity to get regular fresh air, recreation, good quality food. So thinking about they're at the bottom of the ship, steerage, cargo area with other potential brides. You know, they said the whole time I was miserable, I was seasick, I was throwing up all day. I relied upon the goodness of these people who I just met to try to bring me food. So the travel over was also very difficult and miserable for many of them. Now, that other question of who paid for their passage is also very important because it was primarily the men. So the men would essentially send away, commit to essentially, I wouldn't say buying their wives, but at least buying their wife's passage. And she would essentially arrive to join him. So sometimes spouses would be reunited. Other times, spouses would meet for the very first time. So these women then were financially indebted to these men. So if you found out, for example, that this wasn't the person that I thought this was, or this wasn't the, you know, what I signed up for to be a bride, you know, these women, though, were financially pressured then to repay the amount that these men had spent, not just for their passage, but for the immigration process, which would be in the hundreds of dollars. So if these women in fact ran away, their former husband would try to recoup their initial investment from their former wife's new partner. So there was, you know, there were fights breaking out between the men saying, well, that was who I paid for, but she's with you. So men would try to recoup their investment from their former wife's new partner. Now, some men, as we also talked about before, would bring over these women with either A, the purposes of not actually marrying them, but selling into them to the houses of prostitution, or found out that maybe, you know, I cannot afford this. And this is what they would also sell the wives off, who would be indebted to these, you know, honestly, pimps and gangsters that would be proliferating around essentially Honolulu Harbor and in other areas of immigration. So these women would also be sold into these houses of prostitution. And think about, you know, human trafficking and human slavery right now. People are like, well, why do these people fall into this? They said, well, there's citizenship issues, there are financial issues, there are personal issues. It's a multi-layered reason that these people feel that they do not have choices.
Thank you for tuning into Ship History Radio. Stay tuned for part two of this interview, where Dr. Nakamura details the hardships for picture brides once settled into the plantation. From less pay to the, quote, double day or women's work in the fields, in the home, and sometimes even taking second jobs, we will talk about gender disparity and domestic violence. You'll learn about racism and segregation on the plantations and how Japanese workers fared compared to other communities. We will also learn about how World War II and internment affected the Japanese community in Hawaii and issues around citizenship. To learn more about the Steamship Historical Society of America, visit sshsa.org.